Welcome to Coffee House Shots for Spectator's Daily Politics Podcast. The Liberal Democrats are about to choose a new leader, but Jo Swinson, the favourite, has bowed out, saying she doesn't feel that she is the right person to carry on Tim Farron's mantle. So what next for Britain's third biggest political party? And what, if anything, can we expect from the Queen's speech tomorrow? I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bowles to discuss. Now, Katie, you know, as soon as Tim Farron stood down, everybody kind of expected him to, the bookmakers had Swinson as a shoo-in. It seemed as if it was hers for the taking, and yet she has written this rather sort of sad, sorry article saying she wanted to be deputy leader, but she didn't want to repeat the male mistake of egotistically taking a job that she didn't think she was cut out to do. Now, set aside this rather sexist jibe against us poor men, what do you think is going on with Lib Dems?
Well, I think by saying that she wasn't going to repeat the mistake of, you know, egotistical men, she was maybe allowing for egotistical men to become leader. So self-fulfilling. I think the Lib Dems have... Lots of Lib Dems were unhappy with Tim Farron as leader from the offset. They didn't think he was from one wing of the party, which they didn't think was that representative.
The evangelical Christian wing, which is always in conflict with the liberal wing. Rather exposed in the agony of his brief leadership.
Exactly. And you never got the impression that Nick Clegg was particularly fond of Farron as his successor. Now there's a fight to get it back more, I think, how it was under Nick Clegg. Mm-hmm. And Vince Cable is someone who has said he wants to do this. He could also perhaps give Jeremy Corbyn a run for his money when we get to the category of, you know, pale, stale male leaders.
Right. And James, I mean, David Laws was quite quick to slap down Tim Farron, basically saying, well, you know, views like yours aren't basically acceptable anyway. But I'm trying to work out to what extent the public would have noticed or cared about a schism in the Liberal Democrats. They might have thought it was strange how Tim Farron spent a lot of time being asked about gay sex. But really, the ideology of this party, is this the problem, that it's not clear enough?
Well, the election did suggest a return to kind of two-party politics, you know, Tory and Labour both polling over 40% of the vote for the first time in decades. I think the case for Vince Cable is simply this, is he is a recognisable brand. He will get himself on the media. You know, he and Nigel Farage are probably the two non-Labour or Tory politicians who developed the highest media profile in recent decades. And that is essentially the case for Cable. He is a short-term fix to the Lib Dems' problems of struggling for relevance.
So, Katie, do you think it's now his for the taking?
I think there's still other people in the party who might be keen to go for it, but I think Vince Cable, after Jo Swinson, is the most likely choice. He has the name recognition, and right now, when they are struggling for relevance against Labour, they need someone like that. They also, with Tim Farron, he was someone who looked very at home at a protest, but you have Jeremy Corbyn, who beats anyone on that. He is the ultimate protest king. He looks at home at a rally. So it makes sense that they go more to kind of the centrist alternative to the Conservatives, if you are more liberal-minded, than go for the people who go to rallies and are swing voters between Labour and Lib Dem.
I mean, James, the strange thing right now is that there is plenty of political territory for the Lib Dems to take if they wanted to. I mean, the liberal, socially liberal centre, the pro-EU, the kind of the gender that Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson have been talking about does seem to be pretty big. I mean, it's quite common complaint that you hear, I'm a sort of Remainer, there's nobody I can really vote for. The Lib Dems ought to be able to take that territory. Now, they didn't in the last general election. Perhaps that was because of Tim Farron's confused leadership. But it's not as if the political ground has got no room for them.
There's certainly political space to be carved out by the Liberal Democrats right now. Jeremy Corbyn has obviously moved Labour to the left, and he is interpreting the election result as permission to go even further to the left. You've got a Tory party that has, on lots of issues, moved to the right. I suspect it will move back towards the centre a bit in the coming years.
In what ways back to the centre?
I think you won't see any Tory leader repeating citizens of the world, are citizens of nowhere.
Right. So they might row back on the kind of anti-globalisation rhetoric.
Yeah, anti-metropolitan. Mm. I think you will see the Tory party trying to be more in touch with modern Britain and less. At times, weirdly enough, because she was one of them, Theresa May seemed positively hostile to the 48%. Mm. I think that'll go because I think it's cost them seats in Oxford, Weston, Abingdon, Kensington, Canterbury, those places. Vince Cable, though, I mean, I think this is he is good at getting himself on the telly. He is 74 years old, though, which does make him old. And he is regarded, has long been regarded in the Liberal Democrats as difficult to work with. Sean Kemp, Nick Clegg's former press secretary, tweeted today that this was the first time that Vince Cable had talked about leadership not in anonymous quotes to the Sunday Times. And I think there'll be that tension there. But he will get the Lib Dems recognised. You know, if Joe Swinson wasn't going to go for it, he is obviously the most sensible solution. And he's going to have a lot more cut through the public than Ed Davey, for example, and someone else is likely to go.
So, Katie, tomorrow we have a state opening of Parliament. It's one of these strange days that just gets so much television attention, where, you know, in fact, it's not that big a deal. I mean, the Queen will read out a legislative agenda. The question is, what will that agenda be? Had the Conservatives won the election, we'd say, oh, well, obviously she's going to read out the Tory manifesto. Now, I guess we'll find out for the first time how much of that manifesto is going to survive into the Tory-DUP alliance. What are we hearing so far?
Yeah, you get the impression that Tories are actually scrambling around for things they can put in it, which aren't going to be a problem. A lot of the unpopular manifesto will be binned. We're not expecting to hear anything more about social care or grammar schools. There will be a focus on Brexit, anti-terrorism measures, which is something they can get votes on. And also, you know, the strength of the union. I think on Brexit, what would be interesting and what we're still not 100% sure about is how explicit they will be about the terms Britain is leaving the EU on. Because in the Tory manifesto, they said Britain will leave the single market and Britain will leave the customs union. They will want to put that in, but the question is whether they think that, given that the majority, well, not a majority, given that the working majority is so tight, can they get the more ardent Remain MPs in the Conservative Party to back it if they put it in?
So, James, the story tomorrow won't be what's in the Queen's speech, it'll be what has been left out of the Queen's speech.
Yes, indeed. And also, I think it will be how we still haven't seen this Tory DUP confidence and supply deal agreed. And I think this is, so I think the danger tomorrow is that the speech appears to be thin. People say, oh, where's the Tory DUP deal? We want to see that. And it all adds to a certain sense of chaos. I do think there is something else, though. This is going to be a two-year session of Parliament because of all the Brexit legislation. There is an interesting question that once the Queen's speech is through, Theresa May will have stabilised the situation to an extent. Now, the question then becomes, how does that make the Tory party feel that with the situation a bit more stable, they can then turn to their own leadership question or not? I don't sense that the appetite is there for that right now. But once the Queen's speech is through, that is a major hurdle removed.
Right, but because the Queen's speech is a moment for the government to be brought down if it doesn't get enough votes.
Exactly.
Because the votes in the Queen's speech, which take place when?
About a week after it's introduced.
So they effectively, that will be the test to see the parliamentary arithmetic is there for a Theresa May government. Now, obviously, she wouldn't proceed with these votes if she didn't think she was going to win. But the thing is, Katie, that every vote from then on will basically be a test of the government's stability. And because, you know, you don't always need to pass legislation to govern. The SNP minority government in Edinburgh did quite well 4 years, basically not passing much legislation. You can still govern, you can still do school reform, you can do health reform, you don't need laws for all of these things. But what Theresa May will need to do is pass a lot of rather contentious Brexit bills, the Great Repeal Bill and other similar bills on immigration and on regulation. She'll have to get these not just past the Commons, but past the House of Lords as well. Now, do we know anything more about how on earth she is going to get this past the House of Lords, given that they amended even the Article 50 bill something like 35 times?
Yeah, and obviously the great irony is she called this snap election to help with this, to strengthen her hand, to mean that there was going to be less problems with the House of Lords. I think there was a worrying sign we talked about last week when the minister in the Brexit department who dealt the most with the Lords exited the stage. So they've got even more problems there.
That was George Bridges.
Yeah.
And James, I have yet to hear a Conservative explain to me how they're going to handle the House of Lords problem. Sure, I can understand how they're going to get a majority in the House of Commons. I can understand how they, you know, they might be able to cling on by not passing too many contentious votes. I can't understand how they're going to get the Great Repeal Bill and all the other EU-related bills passed a House of Commons which only let Article 50 pass by the skin of its teeth with pages and pages and pages of amendments. So are you any the wiser?
The House of Lords ultimately backed down on Article 50 because of the mandate but the referendum and the Commons vote had created. The problem is that the Tories' failure to win a majority, as Katie said, having set out their Brexit plan, muddies that mandate. And it is very easy to see how peers will say, hang on a second, yes, Britain's voted to leave the EU, but the fact you didn't win a majority shows that they haven't actually voted to leave the single market or leave the customs union. I think we could be heading for a constitutional crisis if the Lords won't back down or not. So we wait to see on this. There is a broader question here, which is how do you get this final Brexit deal through Parliament? I think the Great Repeal Bill, the government will turn around and say, look, hang on a second, if we don't do this, because we've triggered Article 50, we will fall off a cliff in 2 years' time. So you've got to pass this stuff just to kind of tide us over.
Or almost. Perhaps Brexit wouldn't happen. Perhaps that's another scenario people were thinking.
But that is not in the gift of the House of Lords. One of the other things that Theresa May has invited with her failed election gambit is the EU to cause mischief. Mm-hmm. She's invited the EU to say, hang on a second, if we can't, you know, you can stay in if you want. That, all that kind of stuff is now back on the table.
And Casey, when we come to consider parliamentary authority and how much legislation is going to get through, as James says, the House of Lords did, they roughed up Theresa May a bit in her initial Brexit legislation, but they backed down in the end on pretty much everything. They backed down for two reasons. One, as James says, that they ultimately knew there'd been a referendum to enact Brexit. But also, Theresa May had the authority of somebody who had quite a big majority of 50 or 60, because everybody thought that if she had an election, that's what she could get. So she had this kind of unspoken authority, which she certainly doesn't have now. So the House of Lords now would, I suppose it could reject it, but the question is, how many peers would want a general election? Because if they wanted to reject, for example, the Tory, you know, say a central part of Brexit legislation, they could lead to a constitutional crisis, which could lead to a general election. But I guess that depends how many Labour MPs and how many Labour members of the House of Lords would want a general election that could conceivably result in Jeremy Corbyn's premiership. So maybe the Tories' secret weapon here isn't so much having unionist politicians, it's having Labour MPs and Labour peers who don't want Corbyn and therefore won't rock the boat too much.
Yeah, although, at the first PLP meeting after the general election, Jeremy Corbyn received a rapturous response and all the MPs, you know, adored him and said how great he was. But you still get the impression behind the scenes that lots of these MPs that are visibly clapping him don't actually want him to be Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. They still have similar reservations that they had before the election, that they had when they mounted this coup. And those are echoed probably even more in the House of Lords by the type of Labour politicians who have been made peers.
Yeah, but because they tend to be. The Labour peers especially tend to be of a kind of new Labour era. You've got the John Reeds and people like that who are even less keen on Corbyn than Labour MPs.
Exactly, but these peers are also the ones who are particularly Europhile. They feel very strongly, if you look at people like Peter Mandelson, they feel very strongly about staying in the EU or having a softer Brexit. So I think there is a bit of a battle there. I think the thing that's working against Corbyn is ultimately he's seen as being, you know, a closet Brexiteer. So he doesn't have quite the pro of being the safe bet if you want to make a softer Brexit. But I still think some of these Labour peers, they feel so strongly on Europe that if they do feel that a general election with Labour at the front would mean that you don't get this hard Brexit, they might stomach Jeremy Corbyn.
Right. So, James, then Theresa May would be saying to both the Commons and the Lords, you've basically got a choice, Brexit or Jeremy Corbyn.
One of the things that is going to help Theresa May out over the next few years is, ironically, something she wanted to scrap, the Fixed-Term Parliaments Act. In the current setup, it is very difficult to see who else could form a government apart from the Conservatives, with some minor party support. And so I think that will prevent the breakdown of things. But I think the real thing is, what happens in 2019? What is the deal at the end of the Article 50 process? Because that will have to get through both houses, I think. And that will be the moment at which we might end up having to have a general election, because that might be stalemate.
Well, let's see how it all develops. James and Katie, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffeehouse Shots, in the iTunes store, and to the magazine itself from just £1 a week on spectator.co.uk/subscribe. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Nick Hilton.